Good morning. My name is Candace, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Gartner Prospering in the World Where the Consumer is Truly the King teleconference. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Mr. Sher, you may begin your conference.
Thank you, Candace. Good morning, and I'd like to welcome you to this Gartner teleconference. My name's David Sher, and I'm a research director in Gartner's Industry Advisory Services, covering banking and investment services, and specifically, retail brokerage, wealth management, and online financial services. But we're going to be talking today not just about banking and investment, but also about retail and the many ways in which we're changing the nature of the world today, and how we're moving into a world where the consumer is truly the king. So the issue becomes, how do you prosper in such an environment? You might think of this as a journey from a provider-ruled land to a consumer-ruled land. And the road that you follow on that journey to have success with consumers is neither straight nor smooth. There are dangerous innovations lying out there and lurking threats from expected and unexpected directions. These must be detected, managed, identified, and dealt with. Because you're dealing with consumers who can be somewhat fickle, there will be starts, stops, and direction changes to meet those changing consumer needs. And it's important to realize that technology can help in making the journey to a successful, to making the journey a successful one, but it must align to the needs of the consumer, not just to those of the enterprise. So we're going to be talking about three things today, because flexibility, adaptability, and being able to rapidly respond to these issues are going to be the key to survival, not to mention success. What we're going to be talking about are, how do consumer attitudes and behaviors drive the difference between success and failure for businesses in the early 21st century, at least those businesses whose core target market is the consumer, directly or even indirectly? What do we see in terms of the market and demographic trends that providers must consider as they prepare their go-to-market strategies and their plans, how they serve their customers, their business models, and how can they use technology to better address these? And finally, how should providers of services that are directed at consumers leverage the web, and especially the emerging aspects of Web 2.0, to more effectively meet consumer needs and consumer behaviors? Now, I've spoken on these issues a number of times, and one of the places I spoke about some of this was in Barcelona at one of our recent spring symposiums. And when I was heading over there, it came to me that the thing the Spaniards love, the bullfight, provides a really good analogy for how the world has changed. In the old days, the provider dealing with the consumer was much like the bullfighter, the matador. They would show that they were in control by how they managed the bull. They set the rules. They set the pace. And it was up to them to determine how and when, except for the occasional mishap, the bull was gored. And similarly, that's how providers have run things historically in the past, going back through from the middle to late 20th century predominantly. Providers set all those things, and IT development, which occurred basically during that same period of time, was enterprise-driven, at the pace and focused on the needs of the consumers. But some of you have probably seen the running of the bulls in Pamplona, and that's a far more disorganized activity, and it's a far different relationship. There, the bull is in charge. The consumer controls the relationship. The consumer sets the rules. The consumer sets the pace. And very often, it's a lot faster than you'd like. Concurrently, what that means is that the IT development must be consumer-focused, because it's just like when you run with the bulls in Pamplona. You need to move as fast as you can, get out of the way, or surely you are going to get trampled. Now, part of what's behind this is something that we've seen in the States, in Western Europe, and around the globe. And that's the fact that we have had an incredible, or we're right near the tail end of an incredible shift of generations that drive changes to the business model and drive changes to the terms of trade and control of the relationship. You know, if we just look at the 20-year period from 1990 to 2010, we see an amazing shift. In 1990, the pre-boomers, the people that Tom Brokaw identified as the greatest generation, the folks who lived through the Depression, fought in World War II, dealt with the post-war years as adults. They were almost half of the population. They were 42%. And most of the rest of the adults in the population, and that's who we're talking about, the adults here, were boomers. So those are the blue group and the red group in this chart. Only about 15% were even the Gen Xers, the people who've come since the boomers. And obviously, if we're talking about adults in 1990, none are the Gen Ys, the 31% we'll see by 2010, the echo boomers or the millennials, the generation who's grown up in the age of the iPod and the cell phone. So in 1990, pre-boomers were senior management, pre-boomers and boomers were the consumers, and everybody was used to kind of that hierarchical command and control way of doing business and living life that had been established by the wars that were fought by the greatest generation. But now shift to 2010, just a few months from now. Boomers and Gen X are senior management. You might have a few pre-boomers hanging around in the boardroom, let's say, but they're a much smaller percentage of the population. By 2010, only 17% of the adult population will be those pre-boomers. Boomers, Gen X, and Gen Y are consumers. And along with that, we've moved from a mass media way of doing things, from one to many, to much more of a peer-to-peer, from many to many. The use of social networks and communities is continuing to influence, and that's affecting all of these generations, but especially the younger ones. So the bottom line is, if you think about it, society and the markets into which we sell our services to consumers have changed faster than the underlying businesses, and typically faster than the underlying IT that's driving or supporting those businesses. Now, it's not just age, but in a very real sense, it's technologies that divide the generations. If you look past over the 100, almost 110 years now, since about the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, through the most recent turn of the century, about each generation has seen a new technology, a new communications and media technology, or more than one, that's radically changed the way they view the world, they interact with others, and they deal with the world around them. So for my grandparents who have passed on, born right around the turn of the 20th century, it was the telephone. If you were middle class and in an American household in those days, you probably were getting the telephone in. But if you were from the generation before, you'd never seen that. It was something very new to you. For my parents' generation, it was radio. For myself, as a baby boomer, smack dab in the middle of that cohort, it was television. These are the technologies that for each generation, it's always been there as they were growing up. It was a natural part of the landscape, not something new and different that they had to figure out how to understand as an adult. Now, the generation that followed mine, Gen X, I've looked around, I've talked to a bunch of Gen Xers. Those poor folks, they only got the half steps. Cable TV, well, it's a little different from regular TV, but not all that much. Cassettes, not really that much different. And now we look at Gen Y, those who are about 18 to their early 30s, and still some teenagers. They have the PC, the CD, webs, cell phones. They're surrounded by technology on an ongoing basis, and it affects how they deal with the world and how they think about the world. Across these different cradle technologies and in each generation, we've been moving from less to more, from one-to-one to one-to-many, and now to many-to-many with social networking, from sound to sight and sound, from hardwired to broadcast, even if it's over the wires, analog to digital. We just saw how that happened with the changeover in American TV, and from narrowband to broadband. More information, more means of access, more ways to talk to one another, more sources of information, more ways to hear and be heard. And that's been changing the dynamic of who controls the conversation and how the conversation goes on about products, services, companies, ways of doing business, ways of living your life. I want to take a moment to look at how in our consumer data we've been seeing some of these changes begin to ripple through, how people deal with their financial institutions and how people deal with the way that they shop and buy goods and services. We've been tracking online banking in the U.S. and the U.K. for a number of years, and as you can see from this chart, we went from less than a fifth of the U.S. population and not much more of the tenth of the U.K. population in 2003 that were online, to almost a third of the UK population and nearly half of the US population that's online as of early 2009. Banking online, and by that we mean you've done internet banking within the past month. Well, those numbers are getting pretty big. But if you look at the next slide, where we start breaking it down by generations, you can see that there's also a replication and differences across the generations. If we go back a few years, those numbers would be far lower in every generation. And in fact, we've seen some things where the older consumers, the boomers and the pre-boomers, have been catching up. But whether you look at the the gray bars of the UK or the blue bars in the US, you can see you get a step fashion increase. So that over half of UK and over half of US Gen Y are banking online, compared to less than one in five, or just about one in five for US pre-boomers, and less than one in 10 for the UK. So we see that as different generations become more dominant as customers of financial services and as customers of retail shopping organizations, the need to deal with these newer technologies and their willingness to look at things and people in many different ways becomes more and more important. We also see it when we look at shopping behaviors. We asked our consumers in the U.S. and our consumers in the U.K. whether they agree that they would conduct financial transactions via mobile, a mobile phone, a cell phone. And although numbers are smaller, we're only up to about a fifth of Gen Y in the U.S. and the U.K., we can see that, again, with each generation, willingness to have new forms of interactivity with their providers and new ways of doing transactions and viewing their information are becoming increasingly important. Similarly, if you look at mobiles for shopping activity, you see some of the same patterns. One interesting difference here, by the way, is whereas in financial services, the U.S. tends to be a little higher in each age group than their compatriots in the U.K., it's the reverse here. We believe some of that relates to the fact that the U.K. and Europe have been more dominant in their use of mobile devices with SMS, short message service, what we might call text messaging, in the U.S., so that you see that they're a little ahead of us. But in the U.K., over half of Gen Y consumers have done some kind of shopping activity by mobile, and over a third of U.S. Gen Y are doing the same. So again, increasingly, we're seeing this interest in having new ways of doing things or in finding better ways to do the things that they want to do, and that means having more access to information. You can also see that it happens, if you look at the box kind of on the upper left of the chart, that what people are doing them for is very interesting. It's not just to shop online. The single largest use of mobile for shopping is to find a physical store location. The second is to search for products. So we're seeing that consumers are using the mobile as a touch point in coordination with other channels. And that's an important thing to realize as you move forward. Because not only is the technology not only are people's ways of doing things differently, but personal business environments, social environments, and the technologies we use to interact with them are blurring and merging. Go back 10 years, 12 years. Many people, if they had any email address, probably had only one email address. Now, if you think of it, many of us have three or four. You have your office email. You have your real main personal email. You may have a Gmail or a Yahoo Mail account so that if you have to fill out a form but you're afraid of getting spammed, you have something you can put in that'll show as a legit email. Our lives are blurring. People don't want to carry a cell phone for work and a cell phone for home. They expect to be able to manage that aspect of their lives seamlessly, to control their personal calendar and their business calendar at the same time. And as we're also seeing, the technologies themselves are beginning to blur together. If you go from a plain old kind of mobile phone to a smartphone or a BlackBerry or an Apple, well, it used to be 3-4 years ago, the next step up was to go to a laptop. Now we're seeing a netbook that almost straddles the two in terms of the capability, the functionality, what kinds of networks that it can address, its usability, the kind of screen, and what kinds of behaviors you can do. So at all the levels, we're seeing that there's this mushing together, to use a highly technical term, of the formally separate aspects of our lives, the formally separate technologies that we use, and the formally separate networks through which we interact with our friends, our family, our coworkers, our providers. The result of all this is that people are more and more looking for what we might call a multi-channel or a multi-touch point experience. Whether you're looking at the two charts, the two tables on the left-hand side, which talk about individuals' expectations for multi-channel retailing, they are expecting that, or they stated when we asked them that it was important that you would have the same sales and same promotional activities both online and offline, both in the store and via the online experience, that you'd be able to track orders from one channel in another channel, that the product pricing would be consistent, that the product selection would be consistent. People no longer are willing to be tied to a specific device and to have a specific set of products, services, pricing be tied to the device or tied to the channel. We in the industry have often thought of channels as tunnels. A person gets into a tunnel, drives down that tunnel to the other side throughout that channel experience. But in reality, most consumers deal with the different channels as if they were different lanes on a multi-lane highway. And they'll switch lanes from one to another for wherever they see the traffic being clearest. We also see that they want channels to persist so that you can buy in one channel, return in another. More and more frequently, we're seeing, for example, in retailing, the idea of ordering online and arranging for an in-store pickup, and that you can use the web to check store stock. Some vendors are very good at this, others are not. Similarly, if we look at the pie chart, we know from talking with consumers in the U.S. that most of them, the large majority, are using multiple channels in the way they interact with the bank. And in fact, over half, the 29 for 3, the 23 for 4 or more, well over half, are using three or four channels in sequence within a given month. That could be ATM, phone, branch, online, mobile. So when you're thinking about how you plan your technologies for those multi-channel operations, first of all, realize that channels is an enterprise-centric, internally-facing notion. For consumers, you need to think about touch points, the way they access you, not necessarily the channel that they're accessing. But however you look at it, we found that three concepts are key. That information is pervasive, that it's consistent across time, pervasive, that it's spread across time and across channels, that if I look at something now online, when I go into the store, I'm going to have consistent performance, that it is indeed consistent between channels, and people are expecting this kind of unified experience. The day where you have one store price, one catalog price, one online price is no longer able to hold, and that it persists over time and over channel. This is important, especially in financial services. As people begin to use online channels and other non-physical channels for more and more complex activity. So, for example, a person may want to start a home equity loan application online. They're sitting up at 2 or 3 in the morning worrying about their finances or deciding, yes, it's finally time that the smoke has cleared a little bit and we're going to renovate that kitchen, and they start doing the application for home equity line, and they spend 15, 20, 30 minutes on it, and something happens and there's a problem with it. Well, they want to maybe get on the phone at that hour of the night or the morning, depending on how you look at these things, and talk to a call center person. But they want that call center person to be able to see what they filled out and not make them start from scratch. Or they decide the next morning to go into the branch. Same thing. The information that you input in one channel needs to be developed in such a way that you have the ability to see it in all the other channels in real or near real time. And it's not particularly my area of focus, but I would refer to you to some of the work Stessa Cohn and Mary Knox have done, especially in financial services, around the concept of multi-channel integration, because it's an important notion as we move forward. The realization is also that we're getting increasing competition. The innovation is driving more and more competition from every direction. With the biggest single direction, whether it's from traditional competitors or non-traditional competitors, coming mainly from the web. So you have established providers, known, recognized brick-and-mortar businesses, big publicly traded companies that are building out direct models that have different cost structures, different product offerings also, and are just establishing a direct channel. Now, that may seem contradictory to the last statement, but they're essentially saying you're going to give up that multi-channel experience in return for pricing considerations. So you have ING Direct, HSBC Direct, Immigrant Direct that have been offering, well, at least a couple of years ago when there was more variability in interest rates, offering higher interest rates in return for somebody accepting the limitation of the channel. You're also seeing new forms of disintermediation. So disintermediation is the concept, for any of you who might not be familiar with it, that there's a normal kind of value chain that goes on and a normal supply chain that goes on in industry, but that people in between, the middlemen, so to speak, or the middle people, so to speak, can be disintermediated throughout the process. So we see that with LendingTree, that's taking the traditional way of walking into your downtown bank or neighborhood bank and sitting down with your banking officer and giving people the ability to source a loan from a small bank 300,000 miles away from them. We see it with something like Folio FN or ShareBuilders, which is now, by the way, ShareBuilders is now part of ING Direct, where they're trying to take out the middleman in terms of the traditional brokerage relationship, but doing a very simplistic form of investing, very simple dollar cost averaging. Similarly, Insure.com to allow for direct feeds. We're also seeing, by the way, that firms from outside of the industries, particularly in the case of financial services, outside of financial services, are poaching. You have automobile manufacturers, whether it's the straightforward thing that we've come to expect of the auto manufacturer offering you financing through their captive lending firm. But also we know that there are banks and there are car manufacturers out of Japan and Germany that have set up banking operations where people can do their traditional checking and savings operations through Toyota or Volkswagen Bank. We've seen it in terms of transit cards, especially, for example, the Octopus card in Hong Kong, which is the mass transit smart card, where people now have the ability to use that card as a form of money for more and more vendors that kind of surround the subway operations and the other mass transit operations. And we know very well that telecommunication providers, from their activity in billing cell phone calls, for example, have become very good at micropayments and are trying to move into that area. But perhaps the most dominant form of this are the industry disruptors. Whether you're looking at the ability to do simple payments peer-to-peer without involving a credit card or a bank, like PayPal, or the ability of people to lend from one to another without ever having met via Lending Club, Prosper, Loanio, and other entities like that, or the new kinds of industry disruptors around financial services, firms like Mint, Wasabi, or Covestor, that are beginning to allow people to aggregate data, find the best deal, share information, because some of them involve social forums, without the need to do that through a financial services site. As a result, financial services firms we're beginning to see are copying some of these mechanisms and working with some vendors who are actually allowing you. For example, Wasabi, besides allowing consumers to interact directly with them, now offers a product called Springboard, which functions similarly but behind the bank's firewall as part of their online banking system. What we're seeing is, along with this, because of the accessibility of the web and a concept of ambient findability, the fact that you can essentially find anywhere, anything, anywhere, at any time, we're moving from traditional mass markets to niche markets. Mass markets were product-driven, distribution-driven. Price competition was controlled. The consumer could only price out what was readily available to them through a mail-order catalog of the stores in their town. Loyalty and relationships were seen as adding real value. As a result, there were high barriers to change. Now we're into a niche market pull where consumers can find what they want, where they want, and how they want. And that means there's higher availability. That means pricing competition is unbound. Whether I'm looking to trade stocks or I'm looking to buy a TV, I can go online, I can look for multiple offers, I can buy that TV if I trust the shipper from a company that's in another state as easily as I can from the store down the street from me. And in fact, if they have free shipping, in many ways, it's probably easier. We're going to smaller markets with more distinct needs. And as a result, we have lower barriers to change. What that also means is, rather than the traditional models that have been built around mass markets, going for the biggest chunk of people that are the most similar and can be identified through, so to speak, a least common denominator segmentation, you need to think about the long tail, that narrow element as the web helps to provide new and better distribution sources so that you can develop new models that are built around niches. And we'll talk a little more about that in a couple of minutes. Now, along with that, access to product, access and control of information is transitioning and transforming. So go back 8, 10, 12, 14 years. You started with the electronification of essentially paper-driven products or software-driven products in terms of my particular area of focus, personal investing and retail investing. Whether you're talking about Valueline, Barron's, the Wall Street Journal, or the old personal financial manager, Quicken, you were starting to look at things that were essentially print products or pure installed software starting to move online. Then we developed things like Yodlee, which is one of the early account aggregators and is still out there, what you might call the Web.1 products, 1.0 products, where people have the ability to do things online, but in many cases it's a pretty direct translation of formerly offline activities. Eventually, you started to get people who began using, or entities that began using the web and working with the concept of what can be done around the web. And this was happening kind of around the most recent turn of the century, the late 90s, along with the stock market boom. You know, the growth of internet-based investment advice sites like Silicon Investor, Raging Bull, Stock Picker, the growth of Morningstar, the growth of things like Yahoo Online, The Motley Fool. All of those were new entities that really, well, except for Morningstar, were new entities that were really only forming around the concept of the web. And now we have the Web 2.0, whether you're talking Wasabi or Buxford that are more around cash management functionality, GZO or Mint that are getting more into personal financial management and beginning to get into investment management, or Covestor, which is a peer-to-peer investing social network that's now moving into a modality of allowing for peer-to-peer managed accounts. In each case, we're moving from print as the dominant medium to the web as a new way of displaying print to a truly transformative use of the web in ways that could, in many ways, could almost never have been imagined 10 years ago. Along with that, we're seeing obviously a shift in the underlying technologies from plain old XML and HTML through Java and SOAP and .NET, and now to AJAX, REST, JavaScript, rich internet applications, making the web more flexible, more useful, more usable, and more user-controlled. And that's an important element because there's something else going on here at the same time. This is shifting, again, the control. As you move more to more advanced web kind of structures in Web 2.0, not just the terms of trade, but even the terms of how information is consumed becomes more consumer-defined and less provider-defined. Go back 5-8 years, look at an online banking site, look at an online trading site, there was very little flexibility. You took the HTML page the way that it was provided to you. We're now beginning to see people offering more, or using AJAX and other rich internet applications within the browser to allow for more flexibility, even in some cases to allow a user to design their own trading or investment page according to their wishes with the information they want on each page. And along with that loss, that shift of control, is the fact that we now have sites and locations that are totally consumer-driven. You get tip swapping. You get, I heard a story, I guess, last week on NPR about the growth of, as they call them, and it's not my term, mommy blogs, where, you know, mothers of young children go online and blog and interact. And there's an issue coming up now is, are they doing honest blogging, or are they getting kind of payments from certain vendors to promote their products? But you've got reviews, commentaries, complaints. You've got customer-driven innovation where they can actually help a firm understand that better. Crowdsourcing, using social networks and prediction markets to tap into the wisdom of crowds. And by the way, there's a book out there called The Wisdom of Crowds, and if any of you haven't seen it yet, I would recommend it. It's not so much specifically about the web, but it's about the concept that the many often The many, even if they're relatively unsophisticated in a certain area, are often better predictors of the true value or the reality of a situation than any given expert. And we're seeing more and more consumer input into design, but you need to understand that there are limits. Consumers can help you with the evolutionary guidance. How do you improve something? How do you make incremental steps to make it better, that kind of small-eye innovation? But the big-eye innovation, the big new ideas, typically do not come from consumers. It's tough for a consumer to imagine what isn't. They can look at what is and say, I know how I want to make it better, but they can't necessarily imagine what isn't. A classic example of this is in the, I guess it's the mid-80s or so, when Chrysler came out with the first minivan. The consumer input they gathered in old traditional market research methods gave them ideas of cup holders, store more, easier in and out access, all the different things. But consumers didn't sit down at the table and say, I want a minivan. They had to kind of look at that evolutionary insight from the consumer and make the revolutionary leap to determine what would come next. I want to go back now to this concept of the evolution of the web and talk about it within the area that I do a lot of work in, which is retail financial services, and especially retail investing. Now, some of these names under full-service brokers have changed, but you know the underlying firms are really the same pretty much. Go back to that early slide about the comment of the shift in generations. We would say the full-service brokers are still focused on that command-control economy. They were built in the post-war years. They were designed around that idea that there is an expert and there is a non-expert, and information flows from the expert to the non-expert. So they were built on economies of scale. Their core market was, and in many ways still is, the pre-boomers. The relationship was that advisory model. For those of you who are either old enough to remember from the 50s and early 60s or have watched enough TV land to see the reruns, you know, look at the old sitcoms of Ozzie and Harriet, Father Knows Best, shows like that, My Three Sons, where the father was the wise guide and the children were the unknowing sots that made the mistakes and had to be helped. For this group, the web is at best secondary. Typically, they only like to turn on account management activities, letting you see your balance, letting you see your performance, letting you see transaction history, but not to directly trade. And that technology very often is simply brochureware. We then saw the discount brokers who emerged after the shift in commission structure in the mid-70s. Fidelity, TD, Ameritrade, E-Trade, Schwab. They were built more on economies of access. We'll build tools and let you come, but we're looking for bigger and bigger numbers of people to help share out the costs. Their core market is most likely the baby boomers. They are collaborative, although in ways they've been shifting a little more to the full-service broker side. And they look at the web as equivalent. And their technology, typically, although it's starting to change a little, has been Web 1.0. And when they think of webifying something, it's very often thinking of it, as I said, it's that conversion to electronic paper. But up until the last year or two, it's very much been kind of a physical, paper-based, structural, page-based medium. And finally, we have what we refer to the new era brokers. This is just a couple of them, Zecco, Thinkorswim, which is recently been acquired by Ameritrade, as a matter of fact, Trade King. They're focused more on the niche. Their core market, generally Gen X, maybe a bit of the younger baby boomers and Gen Y, much more moved to a relationship, to a community, to the idea of forums. The web becomes the primary channel, and you see increasingly they're using Web 2.0 technologies, rollovers, Ajax, JavaScript, other activities that allow you to have more interactivity with the web. So I guess it would help at this point if I just take a moment to talk about Web 2.0. I think the first important thing to say is enterprises often get it wrong. Enterprises often focus on the technology, the things like plain old XML versus RSS, Ajax, rich internet applications, mashups. That's where a lot of the mindset in the enterprises we talk to is around. What's the right technology? Do I go .NET or do I go Java? But really, it's the non-technologies, the fact that users control the situations, users drive the business models, users can very often set the structure of the information, the metadata, the taxonomies that are involved, that it's decentralized. That's what's having the greatest impact. Because the Web 2.0 more and more opens you up to this consumer-driven world. to the situation where people are in control, not the enterprise. And if you think about what 2.0 is, that technology and architecture is just the bottom layer. By the way, that diagram in the middle is not a big ball of string. It's what's known as the Celtic tree of life. It's the idea that the roots may go down into the ground and the branches may go up to the sky, but it's all woven together. And that's really the thing about Web 2.0. It's not just the technology and architecture. That's the things we were talking about. Ajax, plugins, widgets, gadgets, WOA and SOA and POX and REST. But it's also the community, the fact it's collective intelligence, the fact that users are controlling the content. The classic example of this is Wikipedia. The fact that you have unprecedented user freedom. So you have Wikipedia for kind of non-techies, and you have open source and GNU for techies, more, you know, the shift to open source software as well. And it's also the business and process, the fact you're now getting more and more customer control, more and more community participation. The long tail economics that I talked about earlier. Because you're on the web, because you don't have physical payments, iTunes is a great example of this. You know, there are fewer and fewer record chains out there. I'm not sure if there are any record chains out there right now, but if you talk about a Best Buy or a Walmart, they can only hold a limited catalog. They're going to go for the best sellers, the big hits, the Billboard Top 40. But when you have iTunes out there, if you sell 5 or 10 copies, quote-unquote, of a song in a day, a week, a month, even a year, it costs very little to have that MP3 file or that AAC file out on the web, available on the server for purchase. So businesses can make money through selling small amounts of a lot of different titles that are out in the long end tail of the usage curve, without having to get caught on the costs of the physical infrastructure channel. I want to go back to our consumer data for a moment now and talk about how we're seeing this roll out. We asked consumers in the UK and in the US about their use of financial social networking sites like the GZOs, Wasabi, Mint, Cake, Rudder, Telegraph R in the UK. And we're seeing that same pattern, obviously at much lower levels for banking and financial social network sites by generation. That, again, very low use among the pre-boomers, slightly higher use among the boomers, then higher among Gen X. And, again, if you notice, it varies a little bit by country, but it's steadily going up. And we also see, for example, that there's a lot of lapsed users. So we ask people if they've ever registered for these sites and whether they've used them in the last 30 days. If they've ever registered but they're not currently using, we call them a lapsed user. So there's still a lot of trial and dismissal of these sites. And as a result, a lot of enterprises are saying, oh, this is just a flash in the pan. I really don't need to worry about it. I don't need to think about it right now. We're seeing the same pattern, and this is U.S. data only, in shopping, that the use of social networks for some aspect of shopping is also going up as you go down the generations to the Gen X and Gen Y. But again, fairly small numbers, especially among the people who have the money, the pre-boomers and the boomers, and the older part of Gen X. So, again, you may be saying to yourselves, well, this isn't something I have to worry about. This is not going to be something that's going to drive my sales. And just quickly, we're seeing the same thing on investment forum sites, and I'll go through a couple of these in a moment. And I wanted to share this data with you that, again, a number of people trying them, a lot of people lapsed, not currently using them, but growth in some ways, and an emerging opportunity for those niche market providers. So we're seeing this early stage ramp up of interest in these kinds of services. And the question becomes, how are they structured? Now, as an archetype, we're working out a typology for social networks and financial social networks. But as a beginning, we like to talk about the closed and the open and the established and the disruptors. So we are beginning to see, for example, established providers like Charles Schwab and Scottrade starting to provide social network forums for people. But they're closed. They're only available to their customers. And what we've seen so far of them is they're less tied to, especially in case of Scottrade, not so much tied to trading activity as to overall investor activity, lifestyle, etc. We're seeing another established provider, Broadridge, which is actually not a brokerage, but provides a lot of brokers with services in a variety of ways, including investor communications, leveraging their position in knowing what investors hold what securities to establish an open network, but, you know, they're a traditional vendor. The more interesting ones are the ones up top, whether it's Covestor, which has become a closed network for peer-to-peer money management, Zecco and Trade King, which we talk about often straddle the line. You do not have to be a client of that brokerage to be a participant in their forum, but there are things you can do on their forum as a customer that you can't do as just a visitor. And companies like Cake and Mint that are disruptive, that are open to everyone, that are basically saying, we're going to use a model other than transactions, other than behavioral, and try to leverage the fact that we've got this open market participation. But what's critical, no matter what you're doing, no matter how you look at those sites, and by the way, we don't typically recommend that enterprises try to compete in every area. What's important is that you figure out whether there's a value in it. And that means you have to figure out how you're going to monetize. And for enterprises that are thinking of using some kind of Web 2.0 or financial social network activity, having analytics that let you understand and having the technology tools around business intelligence, around access to databases of transactional behavior, of account behavior, of client behavior, analytics are key to seeing whether you're getting true value out of what you're doing. So this is an example in banking or credit unioning of Safe Credit Union out of California. They launched kind of a Web 2.0 personal financial management site. They use a product from Quicken called FinanceWorks that allows for some of that account aggregation, analyzing information, analyzing cash flows, budgeting, but it's within inside the firewall, part of their online banking experience. They found out, they launched in September 2008, and as of about mid-2009, about 13% of their clients, their online banking clients, have signed up for the service. Great. Now, what does that mean to them? Well, after that 9 months they've been up and running, they were able to demonstrate that getting clients to use this more robust form of online banking made a difference. The average user of FinanceWorks generated a profit 3 times that of customers who just use straight internet banking. The account balances were higher, 14.5 versus 10.2. 10.2 for those who use online banking and only 8,300 for those who are not even online bankers. And they had higher levels of numbers of services and numbers of account held. So being able to take that kind of, okay, we tried this new technology out, we're making use of it, what does it bring us, is important. The other example I have is from Trade King, one of those smaller niche brokers that's very much focused on social networks. Now, the first thing they did is they looked at, well, there's different ways you can be part of the social network. You cannot be in it. You can be, as a client, you can be in it, visiting it, looking, you know, kind of a lurker, but not put out a profile. You can put out a profile, but not share your trades. You can share your trades, but not share your performance, and you can share your performance. Now, first of all, they saw as people increased their level, as people were classified by their level of involvement, as you went up higher and higher, you saw more and more trading activity. So if you say no interaction is X number of trades or 1X, just visiting puts you at 1.77X. Sharing performance means you're at over 4X. Okay, that's great, but does that simply mean that different kinds of people are using this in different ways, and more active traders are more likely for whatever reason to want to share their performance? Again, having the right analytical tools and being willing to measure this over time and being tracking this kind of data over time is critical, because they were able to look at people as they transitioned from one group to another. So they started out with baseline, the people who are not engaged. And then they looked what happened 3 months after they joined the social network. And by the way, just under half of Trade King's customers are at some higher level of their trader network. Well, they saw that if they visited, it gave a small lift, just, you know, 8% lift. They saw that if they had a public profile but weren't sharing trades, they got a 20% lift in trading activity. And they saw that if they were sharing trades, they got a 69% lift in activities. So this was able to take a point in time, measure a change in behavior, track that change in behavior, and then say 3 months later, how has their behavior changed as a result? So again, the idea of using careful business and analytic tools and looking not just at point of time snapshots of data, but being able to track and understand customer data as it changes over time is critical. What's also critical, by the way, for those of you who are in different parts of the world, is that when you look at customer-facing technologies, where you are on the globe, what country you're in, how they act, is important to understand. This is from our just-published 2009 Financial Services Customer Technology Hype Cycle. And I just wanted to take a moment to point out some of the things we've been talking about, whether it's pre-approved SMS technology, again, multi-channel, the financial social networks, the financial services, my portals, those are what we call people like GZO and Wasabi and Mint. But if you look at the four boxes marked in red that say mobile consumer banking, U.S., emerging markets, Asia, Latin America, Western and Northern Europe, it's important as you're addressing these kinds of technologies and, for example, saying, what do I want to do around mobile consumer banking, that you understand your particular market. This is something that definitely can't be generalized across countries and across regions. The way mobile has rolled out, the underlying existence of a basic PC-based internet infrastructure all drive how you use this. And there's kind of, we've seen that there are three phases to technology adoption. The first, the blue line you see on this chart, is diffusion. What is the simple availability of the technology? So, you know, go back 10, 15 years, not everybody even had internet access, even, you know, plain old dial-up. But certainly if you talk about, say, broadband, you know, we're only getting to the point now where large portions of the country have broadband access. Adoption is, okay, if it's out there, when are people using that? Not that obviously has to follow diffusion. If something isn't there, you can't adopt it. But finally, it's absorption. When do you get broad utilization? Because that begins to change how people can use it. You know, until you had some level of broadband adoption, you couldn't have a YouTube and be successful. I mean, you can't do that over a dial-up connection. So the ability of consumers to fully utilize a technology or fully adopt some kind of service is going to be dependent on all three of these things: the diffusion of the technology, the adoption of the technology, and then the absorption. Are you moving into something that already has a pre-existing infrastructure, an ecosystem around it? And those are things that you need to consider as you're looking at consumer-facing technologies. The other aspect, and I'm just going to touch on this briefly, is as you're building up your enterprise technologies, you need to start thinking of what we call the customer-oriented application layer. Too often, the user experience is the last thing thought of. Traditional business and IT focus, going back to the traditional provider-centric world, was from the inside out. The new paradigm is from the outside in. Viewpoint becomes more critical. You need to think, as you develop applications that touch the consumer, you need to develop techniques, technologies, business processes, working with marketing and market research, working with the business units, having test labs for consumers, so that as you develop new technologies that are focused on consumers, you make sure that they're designed with the consumer need in mind, not your need in mind. And a second aspect of that technology development is the fact that we have tended to develop technologies for the fat part of the curve. As we move out and have longer tail needs and a more flattened curve, you'll see the need to develop more highly specialized services. So for example, if you look at this, which again is my core area, retail investing, you have different investor behavior models from the hardcore self-directed to the advised, and you have different levels of affluence from the mass market to the high net worth, people with millions of dollars. The current focus, or the traditional focus of brokerages, has been around that advised model where there's a financial advisor, the affluence, and especially the high net worth. And as a result, we built big, hard, large, deeply designed into the infrastructure applications. As you move to more self-directed, as you move to focusing on the niches that are different parts of the tail, you find out that you need to build smaller, lighter, more rapidly developed applications. So you're going from static applications to more externally focused, flexible applications. Basically, we like to say you can't do a shotgun blast with your technology anymore. You have to be a sharpshooter with a rifle. Because there are a lot of pitfalls in designing technology for the consumer. I've held on to this quote for, I guess it's about, yeah, it's just about eight years now. No one bothered to ask the consumer what they wanted. It's a classic case of engineers leading the charge. This was around why there was low adoption of wireless web services. Well, now, 9 years later, things are very different. The timing matters. Now there's heavy availability of wireless web. There's been an ecosystem of uses, and consumers now see the value in it. And that's the second point. Most people don't want to do more things easily. Now, you know, a lot of the people, a lot of us at Gartner, our clients, are, you know, engineering, gearheads, electronically oriented, technology oriented. We get into the wow factor. We get into the, gee, it's neat. Wouldn't it be neat if I could do this? But most people don't. Most people simply want to do the things they already do more easily. So figuring where you are on that adoption curve is critical to having something that's a success in the marketplace. We've seen that, by the way, with mobile securities trading. It became very big in the late 90s, and then it died off. We're seeing another kind of push on it because, gee, wouldn't it be neat if there were an app for that on the iPhone, and of course now there are four or five of them. But again, is that something that most consumers want to do? We know, for example, only about 2% of U.S. consumers are trading on via mobile devices right now. That's data from ComScore from a very large sample. You know, along that lines, the Ajax and Rich Internet, RIA applications, that functionality is cool. But getting hung up on the wow factor is a bad thing because it's really the client experience that's most critical to success. And as I said, focusing on Java versus .NET, that's the wrong thing to focus on. The vendor and the technology decisions come later. User-focused development, actually having labs or being like anthropologists and going out to people's homes and seeing where they wrestle with trying to use your online banking, that's much more critical. The technology decisions can come later. The goal isn't always to have the most cutting-edge technology. That hype cycle we showed you earlier is very much front-loaded. It's only as you get on that last curve of the slope that you're starting to get to the place where a lot of enterprises and a lot of users are going to be adopting it. So being able to build technologies that allow for rapid adoption and rapid adaptation are often more critical than having, you know, being first mover advantage on some new technology that may not provide consumer value. That means you've got a shift in the pace of change and in the value of being ahead of the curve, but it also means that development times tighten up, and it means being the best is sometimes the enemy of being good enough to do what you need to do. So we like to say it's better to get a B-plus in 3 months than an A-plus in 3 years. Similarly, sometimes you have to try things and be willing to let them fail. We see banks, for example, more frequently using R&D branches because failing fast is often better than succeeding slowly. And that means you're going to be looking at IT organizations that have to drive for higher efficiency, greater flexibility, using tools that move you up the application stack and allow for faster, more agile development, and, of course, lower cost development. So with that, wrap up and maybe have a minute or two for questions. What we'd suggest is when you get off this call, start learning what you don't know. You know, start monitoring the web to see what others are saying about you in terms of customer communication sites and tip swapping sites that are out there. You need a cross-functional team, not just IT, but finance, sales, marketing, to find better ways to get consumer feedback on the web. Looking out over the next year or so, remember, you've got to put the consumer at the center of development activities. They have far more choices. They are the king. You need to get that cross-functional team's learnings implemented. You need to, whenever you're building new applications that touch the consumer or touch the customer, to focus on the customer experience and think about that customer-oriented architecture layer in a very formal manner. And again, and this is a thing that I can't stress enough, you need to work with groups outside of IT, not just the business unit clients, but marketing and finance, to build better business intelligence tools to build analytics that focus on the customer and that will enable you to do the fine-grained segmentation you'll need to survive and prosper. And for the long term, you need to focus on IT agility and adaptability. You need to think about who your core customer segments are and focus on building solutions that are attuned to their needs and drivers. It's not one size fits all anymore, and it's not we can succeed and get everyone as customers anymore. You need to implement systems and architecture that enhance these capabilities, including what we would call light web development tools like Ajax and RIA. And you need to constantly be focusing on re-architecting your IT systems and your business operations around this outside-in, niche-oriented approach, because when the customer is truly king, when the consumer is truly king, and that's the world we're moving to if we're not there already, that you've got to do what the king wants if you want to stay in the king on the king's good side. They have plenty of other subjects out there that they can source their results from. So with that, I'd like to thank you for your time. And operator, I don't know if we have time for a question or two.
Yes, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, you may do so by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, that is star 1 to ask a question. Again, that's star 1 to ask a question. At this time, sir, we have no questions.
Okay, well, we kind of reached the top of the hour anyway, so I'd like to thank you all for your time and for listening in. And as we say, good luck in prospering in a world where the consumer is truly the king. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude today's conference call. You may now disconnect.